Welcome to the E-Commerce Finance Podcast. I'm Stephen Brown, CEO with Ledger Gurus. With me, I have Chris Tondel from Finale Inventory, now part of Descartes. And we are going to talk about insights from a decade of building e-commerce software. Why don't we start with your title? Did I say the new company name right?
Yeah, it's Descartes. It is a Canadian firm. And so you've got that French pronunciation. It's been around for a long time, and they're a public company headquartered in Toronto.
So let's kind of fill in some gaps. You were a co-founder and the CTO of Finale Inventory, and then recently Finale was bought by Descartes.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the journey. So first of all, what does Finale Inventory do?
So Finale Inventory is a inventory management system for e-commerce companies primarily. And so what that means is it's, you know, the core of the processing of physical goods through a business, everything from purchasing, bring goods into your company, core stock keeping operations, and then selling, whether you're selling e-commerce, but also if you have some retail operations or some B2B operations. So it's kind of that whole flow of goods through your organization, both from an operational and a financial standpoint.
And if I read LinkedIn right, you guys got started in 2014. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. We spun out of a prior project that one of my co-founders and I had been doing, and we had a few customers, but we really launched it as a e-commerce focused business in 2014.
So acquisition in 2025, you're continuing on with Descartes and the team. 100%. That's a lot of learnings. I mean, e-commerce 2014 versus 2025. Talk about two different worlds. Let's talk about what are some of the things that you've learned from a decade of working with e-commerce businesses? Like, what do you feel like, any like key insights for sellers a decade on?
I think that the biggest change, I mean, it's just continuous, is just, you know, how much more pressure there is to kind of keep optimizing every part of the business. And when I talk to sellers who've gotten very large, in some cases, 9-figure sellers, where they just talk about the process of just every single aspect of their business having to become more efficient, not just marketing and sales. Of course, that's important, but sourcing, how they import, how they package things, what are the exactly how they're doing shipping, exactly how they're doing fulfillment. So every stage along the way, just every year, they just need to be more and more efficient than they were a year before.
Do you feel like the people that you're talking to today in 2025, piggybacking off what you just said, are you seeing a higher level of engagement around inventory management today versus what you saw in 2014 when you guys got started?
Yeah. And I think it's a higher level around what I would say is the actual like process of inventory management. You know, when we got started, it was just, can I get these boxes out the door at all? Can I do some virtual kitting? Can I kind of try to start to reduce my error rates? Whereas now it's much more just really getting dialed in about, you know, how can I make sure I have exactly the right product in stock and I'm ordering stuff exactly when I need to, and I've got less excess inventory on hand. You know, and so that just requires a lot more rigor in terms of when you're purchasing, how you're accounting for returns, how you're accounting for any errors or giveaways. Yeah. So that just is probably the biggest change.
Yeah. If I look at that time frame, I feel like it's I don't know when you'd say the gold rush began, but there was kind of the push into e-commerce around 2014, where it was just starting to really explode thanks to all the tools, Shopify, social media advertising was still fairly easy and efficient. And now, to your point, 2025, it's hard. Everything's hard. Nothing's easy.
Yeah, anymore. Everything's gotten harder. It was easy for a while, and it got a little harder coming to COVID. And then, of course, COVID made, you know, it was like a second gold rush, a second great boom. And then really the last year is, you know, it just kind of gets harder. It just gets a little bit harder.
So you've spent a lot of time talking to customers with a decade of experience to the point where you had somebody that wanted to buy your software. What are some of the, if you had a list of top things you would recommend, if somebody were to come today and say, hey, I've got, you know, I'm a $1 million, I'm a $5 million business, my inventory management is is a nightmare. What are like some of the top tips that you would share with somebody based on this decade plus of building this software and working with other customers?
You know, it's really just a process, right? Because people are at every different place. You know, we see customers, companies that are even fairly large, and you have a challenging time getting their head wrapped around getting effective SKU or product labeling, product aliasing, and making sure that the same product is, you know, being tracked appropriately as they go across channels, you know, issuing real purchase orders and then tracking that you're receiving against the purchase orders. You know, that's another area where when you're starting out, it might be as simple as a WhatsApp or a WeChat message to order some more product. But and as the business gets more complicated, you really want some more control over that. And you really want to be able to have some more sense of like, okay, this is what I've ordered. Okay, I can actually have software support both. I've placed these orders. I haven't placed these orders. So this is what I need to order in the future. And also to support like, hey, this is when I can expect these orders to come in. And so just keeping track, you know, it's one thing when you're bringing in or ordering, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 times a year. But when you start bringing in multiple containers, you know, on a regular cadence, if you're importing or replacing multiple bulk orders or contract manufacturing orders, it just gets a lot harder to keep track of. And that's, you know, that's kind of a big tip. Like you just need to get out of the spreadsheets and out of the email and out of the WhatsApp or WeChat and into something that's, you know, a little bit more rigorous that you can follow through. And I would say the last thing is kind of integrating all the channels, right? So just, sorry to cut you off there. The last thing is, you know, when you're jumping between just, you know, your Shopify, your Amazon, your Walmart, your TikTok, you know, your Shein or whatever other channels you are, you're trying to go to too many different places. You know, few people aren't all of them, but a lot of people start to go to 2 and 3. And even then it gets to be real challenging.
Yeah. I was going to note, piggyback off what you said. We have a small brand that we bought a couple of years ago. I've talked about it on the podcast. I've had my operating partner on here, and we are feeling the pain of less disciplined inventory management. In fact, we've been using Finale or in some cases not using it enough. And then we get chided by the Ledger Gurus team, like who helps us with the inventory accounting, saying like, guys, where's your orders or what happened here? And it's like, yeah. You know, and we have one supplier today. We're moving to an additional supplier next year. And just the one and a couple orders a year, it's hard to keep track of that, even with spreadsheets and whatnot. It breaks down very quickly. So I second your thoughts there that inventory management is really problematic. In fact, we discovered an issue just, we were finishing up our 2024 taxes. Oh, we love to extend. And we had this big adjustment. We're like, what freaking happened? You know? And so we asked our accountant who was working on the project with us. We were like, hey, can you tell us what happened? And some of it we knew. We had, right after we bought the business, the 3PL, like a couple months after we bought, said, hey, we found some old inventory in the corner of the warehouse. It's all expired. And we're like, dang it. And then we've had some damages. But what we started finding is like, hey, we haven't been watching shrinkage very closely. And we had to take some of it we were aware of, like that big discovery of spoiled inventory. But some of it we discovered, like, the 3PL every month has these little adjustments, and we're like, we're not sure what those are. And so it's all inventory management, and it wasn't a ton, but it's enough to where it's like that's something we need to keep our eye on, because it's bleeding profits, and we need to either, you know, have some insurance or, you know, rework our contract to say, you know, damages, somebody's responsible. But it's enough to where it probably would make sense to financially insure it. And just see how much are we losing through shrinkage.
Right. And not discovering it at the end of the year, but discovering it continuously every month. Yeah. So you can keep on top of that. You know, we had I was talking with a firm, and their issue was they had a customer service team that was basically kind of issuing new merchandise when things were damaged without there being any good tracking around it. Mm-hmm. And so they were they kind of later on discovered that the amount of merchandise that they were basically kind of issuing as a, you know, kind of customer satisfaction thing ended up being very material. But because it was kind of this side door, it wasn't kind of on the purchase order, it wasn't on the sales order, they didn't really know how much that policy was costing them. So, you know, that's the kind of things that you can discover, again, by having a single source of truth that cuts across the entire business.
So we've been working on inventory for a few years with Ledger Gurus. You've been doing it a lot longer than us.
Yep.
What are some of the things that you see when customers fail around inventory management? What are some of the things that they do wrong or they don't do that you'd be like, hey, you know, here's some keys to success. Here's some keys to avoid failure.
Probably, you know, whether you're using a piece of software or using a, you know, spreadsheet, is establishing some SOPs or standard operating procedures and sticking with it, right? There's no magic wand yet in inventory. You know, you actually need to have a little bit of discipline, and that can be a discipline around a spreadsheet. That can be discipline about a piece of software. But if you're not consistent about how you do purchasing, a lot of the sales side you can get in a fairly automated fashion from the marketplaces. But if you're not consistent around how you're doing purchasing, not consistent about how you're handling returns, not consistent about handling back orders, if your business does back orders, that's what I think, that more than anything is kind of establishing this SOP and then sticking with it. And again, this is the kind of stuff that when you're small, you're doing $250,000 a year, $500,000 a year in revenue, probably it's not that big a deal. You can keep it in your head. But as it gets bigger and as you start to add another person or two into the company, you just, more than anything, that's probably the thing to start to think about to begin with.
Yeah. And to your point, I feel like there's many processes of inventory. When I talk about this from an accounting and finance perspective, there's many things that you need to do. And if you don't do any one of those things, your data gets off. You got purchasing, you got receiving, you've got, like I said, shrinkage, something that we had... hadn't been tracking.
Well, even with purchasing, like, you know, there's like more to it, right? Because you've got, you know, placing the order, but you also have a process around, when am I going to order? Like, am I just going to order when I feel it? I mean, that, again, when your SKU count goes up and the amount of dollars goes up, you know, again, you actually want to have some kind of process that is a little bit more regular about, well, here is how I place orders. Here is how I recognize and forecast my future demand. Most of the time, customers have some type of prepayment. And so understanding a procedure for how I'm going to record these prepayments, and this $50,000 that went out the door, now there's going to be another payment when it's received. And so understanding a procedure for forecasting that, understanding that. And then, as you said, the receiving, and then if there's a discrepancy, right? So you ordered X and you received a different quantity or different amount. So just even purchasing, like you start to drill in and you're like, you kind of want some policies for each one.
Yeah, everyone. And then you get like, obviously fulfillment's a big deal. If you're doing your own warehousing, that opens up a whole nother can of worms of processes. I think of the other thing, pitfalls I've seen. Marketing. You pull product from marketing and you don't, it just samples. Samples disappear, you know, and you're like, what happened to my account? There's a lot of little things.
Yeah, you hear a lot about that. Like, it's the purchasing and the sales are the obvious one, but it's those samples, it's those damaged goods, it's those expirations, it's returns. Those are the ones where things start to really kind of go astray. And for a lot of sellers that are doing FBA, what we see is a pretty significant issue between tracking what they have in their own warehouse or their prep center, if they have it outsourced, and then what's at FBA and what's in transit. And, you know, I'll talk to very, very big, very mature sellers, and it's just a big black box. Like, they just don't have good record keeping at all for what is in transit between their prep center and Amazon.
Now, I've seen a lot of businesses over the years think that they need to go to an ERP because their inventory management is a mess, and they feel like an ERP is the answer. I'm leading this, I'm giving you a little bit of a softball, but because I know you and I feel differently, but like, what are your thoughts on ERPs versus a federated system? Or, you know, basically federated is the idea of, I've got my general ledger, QuickBooks or Xero, I've got my inventory management, maybe I have, you know, some other components that are tied together. Do you see, I've seen a lot of, hey, I need to go to ERP, and then it fails and it was really expensive. Like, is the process of the problem? You know, because some people think the software is going to save the day, and then they go to an ERP and they're like, oh, this was a disaster. What are your thoughts there?
I think it's complicated. Like, it's certainly the case that there's businesses for which an ERP totally makes sense, right? You're not going to run a multi-billion-dollar public company on small business software. But the challenge is figuring out where that line is, because in the same way you're not going to run that giant company on small business software, you know, if you try to run a small business on an ERP, the complexity and the expenses really got to control. It's not just the software expense, it's the people expense. You know, a lot of software assumes that the people operating the software have internal in-house knowledge and expertise on each of the disciplines. You have people who've specialized in supply chain, people who've specialized in purchasing, people who are specialized in finance and with accounts payable and accounts receivable and so on. And so when you're a smaller business, you don't have that level of in-house expertise and skill in all these disciplines, and you're not in a position to hire folks in all these disciplines, I think it gets to be very hard. And that's, I think, where the line is, where you start to think about these products that work with a smaller general ledger, whether it's QuickBooks or Xero, most commonly in the United States. And then as the company grows, layering on software such as Finale, but some of the other IMSs, and then in other areas, other kinds of software. And you get a level of flexibility and ease of deployment, right? You don't have to deploy all of it at once. You can address this problem this year, this other problem next year, or 6 months from now. And in doing so, it ends up being something that kind of can grow with you versus I've got to tear apart my business for 6 months, for 9 months, for 12 months, and then put it all back together again. And during that time, commerce can change, but your business can change. And that's, I think, where you get into these failed deployments. So again, it's that level of complexity and then that level of, you know, I have a business that's big enough that I can hire specialists that have expertise in all these areas, because it's kind of assumed when you're in these ERP, mm-hmm. when you're in these ERP systems.
Yeah, and mutual friend of ours, Scott Scharf, and I did an episode earlier this year where we were talking about selecting an inventory management system, and we didn't get into specifics, but we were kind of talking about some of the dynamics. My thesis is you can be quite large. When we say small business, the hard thing about small business is some people define it differently.
Yeah.
Is it a million? Is it 10 million? Is it 100 million? Is it based on a number of employees? But
early in my career, I did work with SAP as a partnership mm-hmm. manager. I was working for Adobe Systems at the time. And at the time, SAP defined a small business as anything under $1 billion in revenue. And that was a small business.
And I know the Small Business Administration, I think, defines it as anything under 500 employees.
Right.
Which
right.
in e-commerce land, gosh, you could probably... You could easily be
a billion dollar company.
That's easily $1 billion company.
Yeah,
you know, to be a consumer products business, the way you can leverage software and partners. So my thesis is you could easily be tens of millions of dollars in e-commerce before you need to be considering an ERP.
Yeah, for customers that adopt Finale, we do see customers leave to ERPs, but often when they're in the many tens of millions of dollars, sometimes into the nine figures. And the usual drivers for that end up being the multi-entity or multi-currency. You know, mm-hmm. so people start to have, you know, they actually don't just sell into Canada or sell into the UK, but they actually have a subsidiary there. They have employees there. That tends to be a pretty big driver for us. They get a level of operation complexity around manufacturing, around contracting, you know, sometimes financial complexity can drive it. But again, it's not 5 million or 10 million. It's 50 million or 100 million is where we see people really start to say, you know, hey, it's time to leave, and then have a successful transition. We do see people leave at smaller, and then it tends to be a lot more, it's a little bit less clear how well that works out when they're smaller. Because again, I think the challenge, if they find that they're having challenges with Finale, or, you know, to be fair, the other people in our space, I mean, there's other products in the IMS space that form a similar role. If they're having trouble because those products are feeling difficult or complicated, or they can't work with them well, going to the ERP doesn't really solve that problem. Again, you know, kind of you need to build that discipline. You need to build those standard procedures, build in-house expertise in a variety of areas, as I was talking about earlier, that you'll need to succeed at that 50 million level or 100 million level, whether you're on an ERP or not.
Let's take a little dive into a different topic. You posted some stuff on LinkedIn that went kind of viral. You were talking about Finale and how you guys bootstrapped the company to exit. So you guys didn't take any investment money with Finale. It was all bootstrapped.
That's right.
Which I think there's probably some lessons there we could tease out, because a lot of e-commerce, I think the days of getting investment in e-commerce for the most part are over. You don't see venture capital putting money in. You might get some money from friends and family. How did you guys, I mean, let's talk a little bit about this. The different economics, like you, instead of having to buy inventory, you're having to hire people. How did you guys, focus on profit from day one, or how did you guys make that work?
I mean, it was certainly challenging, right? So in the early days, we had to develop kind of a lot of discipline. We had to build up the software with just the skills that the three of us that were starting the business had on hand. And then evolved, whether it was selling and marketing or supporting it. And then that part was okay. But then it was kind of that discipline to not hire, right? We got to a point where if we were going to raise money, you'd say, oh, we can hire a team. We can expand faster. And we had to accept a longer road, you know, arguably probably it's a little bit slower growth, a little bit less ability to invest. But in return, we're able to bootstrap forward through the 2010s and all the way to the exit. And so we ended up not actually hiring anyone on the engineering team until 2018. So 4 years on, we'd have one person on the sales side. We had somewhat limited in terms of our ability to go to market. But the result was good, right? Because we always had control. We always felt like we were in control of our own destiny, which was a pretty powerful feeling.
Now, you're based in Silicon Valley, so I imagine there was a lot of pressure to raise money, right? That's what they say. You got to raise money. Yeah. You're not serious about your business. Like, did you guys have investors that were wanting to invest in the business?
Yeah, we certainly had people. I mean, we certainly have been well connected around here in the Valley. And we had, all three of us have been involved in venture-backed companies before. And we wanted to choose a different path. And the crux of it was what I was alluding to earlier, was this idea that we had control of our own destiny. We felt that if we could grow the business consistently, you know, be able to not always be at the mercy of having to raise another round of capital, we would have a high chance of getting to a good exit. When you raise financing, you're going to be, by definition, operating at a deficit, right? You're going to be losing money to spend down this cash that's in your balance sheet. And then you're basically making a bet that you will, and before you spend all that money, you'll find a way back to profitability, or you'll raise another round, both of which are not guaranteed. You know, you're neither guaranteed you're going to get back to profitability because you get used to operating at a loss, or you're basically betting you're going to raise another round, which, you know, there's a lot of external factors that can control that. And so on the investor side, you know, they're making dozens of bets. They only need two or three to return the fund. But on the founder side, you get to make one bet at a time. You know, my whole career, you know, this one was really long. I mean, I was involved in this one for over a decade, but I've been involved in, I think, four or five venture-backed startups at this point. I think it's four total. So you don't get a lot of bets. And so the incentive to kind of end up on a one where, like, you can control your destiny ended up being pretty compelling for us in this last go around over the last 10 years.
Now, one of the things that I don't think, I've been in one venture-backed company and then three public companies, one private equity, and then one bootstrap tech company. And I've kind of seen the different experiences. And one of the things you don't realize when you're young, you're like, hey, I got to go venture backed. Or maybe there's a pressure if you're a founder to get venture backed. But a lot of people don't understand math of investment and how your stake get diluted. The other thing they don't understand is the preferential treatment of investors, that usually they get the initial returns and then anybody else gets the scraps. Do you feel like the financial outcome for you as founders was better because you guys didn't take venture capital? Or do you feel like it might've been different or the same had you taken venture back capital?
I think the financial outcome, and certainly the expected value of financial outcome, was certainly better. And the reason I believe that is, it's a little bit complicated, but effectively, to your point with liquidation preferences, you end up basically going double or nothing. You know, you think about it, like each time you take a round, you get more capital to invest for the future, but you also, at the same time, you get closed off a bunch of doors where if you were to exit at those lower valuations, there's no money is going to flow to the founders or the employees of the team. And by avoiding that, we were able to kind of get on a path where, you know, we actually had a really strong financial outcome for an exit that, had we raised money, I think a lot of the funds would have actually flown to the investors versus the owners and the team. So I think that's the biggest thing. And the other thing is, a little bit more subtle, which is that within a few years, we started to figure out that the size of market that was likely available in e-commerce software, certainly outside of Shopify, setting aside Shopify, where have been some truly large exits in the Shopify marketplace, but in the kind of the space that we were in, there really haven't been the kind of truly epic outcomes that where venture capital makes sense, you know, where people get to billion-dollar valuations and hundreds of millions in revenue. And so, you know, I think that for that situation, when the size of market is not going to produce those type of epic outcomes, you really want to avoid venture, because otherwise you end up in a situation where maybe you can raise a seed round or an A or a Series A, but then as you go into those farther rounds, those follow rounds aren't going to be there. And now you've got investment on the cap table. You've got an inability to raise more money because people are trying to recognize the fact this isn't going to turn into a return the fund kind of investment. And then you're trying to find your way to some type of an exit that actually results in a good outcome for everybody. It's just very challenging. And so I think that was maybe not planned, but it worked out in our favor.
So this, I think there's a lot of parallels with e-commerce in that e-commerce can't raise money. We haven't seen venture money in e-commerce for a few years, and I don't see any sign of that changing. So many of them are like you and your founders were at Finale, where they are bootstrapping. I think the math and is somewhat similar, even though the market isn't different in terms of what drives an acquisition when you're bootstrapped. So when you guys had interest in getting sold, what was it that potential buyers were looking at?
The biggest thing was EBITDA, profitability, and the quality of that EBITDA, right? In our case, that really turns into metrics like gross retention and net dollar retention, which for those not familiar with SaaS, gross retention is of your customer revenue that you have this year, how much of it will be back next year, excluding upgrades. And then net dollar retention is how much of it will be back next year, and you get to include the upgrades. So if you're able to upsell people, your net dollar retention goes up. And, you know, those will not be the same metrics for a SaaS company, but I think, again, you know, you're going to be looking at, you know, how much profits there are and the quality of profits. And then, of course, growth. You know, growth was a key aspect of the story as well, both growth through our business and then the plan that we were able to have in conjunction with possible buyers of how that we would then drive growth in the context of that bigger business. And again, you know, again, I'm not sure the exact analogs in e-commerce, but again, if you're able to put yourself into a bigger company where there's a clear picture over how you're going to drive some additional, either it's EBITDA expansion or top line revenue expansion, you know, that clearly is going to help you have a better
outcome. Yeah. If I were to make the translation, I think for e-commerce, it's lifetime customer lifetime value.
Yeah.
It is obviously profit, EBITDA, which is that fancy finance word that finance people like to use. It is, I think both industries have customer acquisition cost is a big thing people are looking at. It's distribution, you know, how well distributed you are. If I get plugged into a bigger company, will that expand my sales if they have better distribution of, in your case, software, or in the case of e-commerce, you know, maybe somebody's selling on Shopify and a little bit of Amazon and they plug into a bigger company that has good wholesale relationships and can expand it. At the end of the day,
it's international relationships.
International relationships. Yeah. And I think, you know, when people are thinking about businesses, and unfortunately, I feel like software and the software world has had a huge influence on the business world in general. Everybody's like, grow, don't worry about profits. And I think that's a luxury that only a few, even in software, there's only a few businesses that have that luxury. And even then, their outcomes are not assured versus, hey, I'm going to focus on creating value, creating profits, creating growth, just business fundamentals. And I don't care what industry you're in. If you're doing those things, there's people that are going to want to buy you. And if you're not doing those things, it's going to be hard to sell your business.
Yeah. And that gets back to this question of raising money. And, you know, people are raising money on the bet for the future and on in the future, this revenue growth would then translate into earnings, which in some segments and in some markets, it's 100% the path to success, right? But in other segments and in other areas, it's not going to get you there. And that's where, again, to your point, getting back to EBITDA, good quality earnings, and than some of the underlying metrics that stand behind them that kind of show the continuity in the future make such a difference.
So you're at a crossroads with Finale Software. I feel like the e-commerce industry is at a huge crossroads with all of the changes we've seen over the last few years, the latest being the crazy tariffs that and changing of international import dynamics. What are your thoughts around the future of e-commerce? I know you're focused on a segment, but I would argue it's a very important segment. Let's talk about a couple of like hot topics, you being a technologist. How real do you feel like AI is? Everybody's talking about AI. You know, I'm seeing a lot of talk about AI from Shopify. What are your thoughts on AI and e-commerce?
There's a few areas where I think AI is incredibly real today, right? So ChatGPT specifically, not even broader AI, but ChatGPT specifically has created a consumer brand and a consumer pattern of behavior in a very short amount of time. I think it's difficult to imagine will be unset. And, you know, product discovery is already happening in ChatGPT. And, you know, people are still figuring out like how that works, but this is not unlike, you know, I'm old enough to remember when Google search came on the scene in late 90s and new patterns of behavior emerged. And at first it was really hard to understand how it was going to work. And there's also huge efficiencies. You know, I remember a mutual friend of ours telling me a story about how he was running ad campaigns and, you know, he was just paying crazy low amounts to acquire new customers because they were able to be on this new distribution channel. So I think there's been a lot of disruption there. And I think people who move quickly to understand, and I don't pretend to understand, who figure out how to then take advantage of that new consumer buying behavior are going to do really well.
I agree with
marketing
you.
I've been
watching the kind of AI commerce this year. I feel like it's evolved. Initially, I thought, oh, you know, everybody's thinking about AI as, you know, ways to run your business more efficiently. But I actually think AI commerce is massive. And OpenAI has a partnership 100%. With Shopify. They're already surfacing product recommendations. Actually, I talked about it in an earlier episode. I actually bought my first thing through ChatGPT. Literally had a bracket on my RV generator exhaust that had broken. And I like took a picture and was like, hey, what is this? And I was like, oh, that's your bracket, blah, 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 blah. Oh, and here are some places you can buy replacements. I was like, cool. Boom. Click. Transact.
Yep.
And so the last couple, and I really feel like it's only been the last, not even since January, I feel like it's been about 4 or 5 months that we're starting to hear that. And I'm like, it's only a matter of time before that becomes even more seamless. And I'm only, my question is, when are they going to open up the floodgates and allow advertising? Right, that figuring out how to create an advertising marketplace within AI.
And again, this is going to be early adopters, early movers are going to have an advantage, right? Because it's not all companies are going to be able to move quickly. It may not even be the obvious companies. And so again, when a new distribution channel opens up, initially click-throughs are awesome. Yeah, I saw a few months ago, I forget who posted it, it's led with a picture of the first banner ad ever on the internet. And it's something like a 30% click-through rate, or maybe even higher than that. Insane. It was the first ever banner ad. Well, as you know, today, I mean, what click-through rate? It's 1 in 10,000. I mean, banner ads, like, no one clicks on banner ads.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the same thing here. And it's going to get worse. And again, that'll move. I think marketing technology is another big area. You know, we've done a lot with that and continue to do a lot with that. Coding's a big area. I haven't seen generative AI really hit in supply chain and logistics. You know, yet I've seen other types of AI, you know, there's a lot of use of machine learning around vision in interesting ways, but I haven't really seen generative AI, LLMs, ChatGPT, kind of in those core transaction processing workflows. We're seeing some early glimmers with some MCPs, but nothing I've seen have good adoption.
Well, there's a lot of data there. So there's things that could be done, I envision, right? With the amount of data that you're doing, that's going on in the supply chain or in inventory management. I think the thing that everybody wants is smarter, easier forecasting. Do you envision AI helping make that possible?
I think AI more broadly has some potential. Generative AI, the new thing with ChatGPT and you know, whether it's Anthropic or OpenAI, maybe a little bit less so because it's not super well matched. And it's been a mixed bag, traditional machine learning tanks versus machine learning versus more traditional statistical approaches in terms of really which provide a better forecasting. What I see for smaller businesses is And again, small, when I say smaller, I mean, say under 50 million is forecasting software adoption is hard. You know, I've looked for a long time for forecasting software that is well suited for that segment of the market. And again, they haven't seen companies that really crack the nut. I know there's some stuff out there in the last couple of years, I think, is starting to get there. But it's very often the case that requires a lot more expertise and specific forecasting knowledge than you'll typically see available to a company that can't hire a full-time forecasting person with expertise in supply chain. So I think there's some software out there that's starting to get there, but it's, you know, it's also hard. I think sometimes customers or sometimes companies in the space find it, you know, easier to do maybe a little bit more helping, supporting their ad hoc forecasting. So I think it's unclear, but I actually don't think that generative AI is going to make a big change in that, big change immediately. I do think there's some really interesting things that happen in terms of assessing data, but it hasn't been put together yet. So generative AI techniques or LLMs are really good at coding. You know, they're not really good at directly processing data, but there's a world where you can then interact with a human, with a querier, and actually generate code on the fly to answer questions or build models that you would not otherwise be able to do. And I'm not aware of tools that are there yet, but I think that's a really interesting area of kind of taking these initial things we're seeing in coding tools, which are there with AI, but then doing things that are more specific for specific applications to allow folks who are not coders to actually effectively create code without even necessarily thinking that they're actually creating code. That's kind of hand wavy, but I think that might be very big.
Outside of AI, any other thoughts around the future of e-commerce?
It's not going away. That's for sure, right? You have a world where more people in 2026 are going to buy online than bought online in 2025 and so on into the future. I think the question is, where are the profits going to flow? And, you know, are there going to be a lot of profits in, you know, for businesses that are, say, between $1 million and $50 million in revenue? And what worked a couple of years ago, you know, find some products, source some products, and kind of be a middleman is going to be hard, right? So you're going to need to have, it's, you know, making money in business is never easy. And so you're going to have to evolve. You're going to have, whether it's creating brand and narrative and storytelling is what makes your business distinctive, whether it's working with contract manufacturers in a really interesting way to create special make products. We've seen a lot of companies have success with customizations, whether that is, you know, kind of whatever kind of mass customization where they're basically modifying the product on out before they ship it out, and some type of simple processing. So not remanufacturing, but just kind of some customization. I do think it's going to be hard though to be a middleman where you're basically buying products, importing them, and then reselling them. Because that's a game of scale and, you know, world of, you know, constantly reduced cost of communication. You know, people that kind of sit in the middle are going to just keep seeing their profits squeezed more and more.
I agree with that assessment entirely. Wrapping up, I know you graduated from Stanford in the 90s. Did you have any classmates that are famous?
Oh, did I have any classmates that are famous?
Anybody that went on to found big companies? Like, did you know the Google guys while you were there?
I did not know the Google guys when I was there. I was one step removed from the Google guys, one step removed from Jerry Yang, who was there, who started Yahoo.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. One step removed. Actually, I did meet, the name's escaping me, the co-founder of WhatsApp. Oh, man, I think I was in a study group with him back in the day. You know, this is over 30 years ago now.
Yeah.
He was class of 94 as well. I'm sure there are others. And the name I could have thought through.
I was just curious if you knew. It's like, you know, Stanford's notorious for generating tech founders.
It certainly is. And it's still to this day, it is.
All right. Well, let's wrap things up. So Finale Inventory, now part of Descartes. If somebody wanted to connect with you or Finale, what is the best way to do?
You know, the best way is obviously through the web, finaleinventory.com. You know, you can actually find out about Finale. You know, I'm also pretty active on LinkedIn. So hit me up on LinkedIn if you are interested in reaching out to me directly.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us today, Chris. And congratulations on a bootstrapped exit and a decade of creating value for the e-commerce community.
100%. Hey, thanks for having me.
Today's episode is brought to you by Ledger Gurus, your partner in mastering cost of goods sold and inventory accounting. Do you trust your cost of goods sold number? At Ledger Gurus, we specialize in helping e-commerce businesses bridge the gap between inventory operations and accurate financials, giving you numbers you can trust so you can make data-driven decisions. Head over to ledgergurus.com and learn how we can help you take control of your inventory and numbers today. That's LEDGERGURUS.com.